The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
We will halve inflation, grow the economy, reduce debt.
Nothing's changed. The circus moves on, rinse and repeat.
We have an opportunity to become Europe's Silicon Valley.
We can perhaps be a broker of some sort with Ukraine.
We expect inflation to come off quite rapidly in the rest of this year. Obviously, we want to see that happen.
What we now need is a period of stable, quiet, serious government.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Stephen Carroll.
I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Caroline Hipkip. Coming up on today's programme, so we have an interview with UK Business and Trade Secretary Kemi Badenoch, who's been at Bloomberg's Qatar Economic Forum.
But first, something absolutely thrilling we're going to discuss. Now, I'm frequently reminded in this programme that I'm not normal, but one of the things that does bother me and I wake up in the middle of the night worrying about is my pension.
Can I tell you, I have never felt so adult or so proud or seen Caroline Hepcourt look so impressed as when I told her that I'd consolidated my pensions and that I had doubled my pension contributions.
It sounds like I'm in good company.
Yes, you are in good company. I will simply reply to that I'm probably better at giving advice than I am at taking it. Oh dear, that should be worrying, shouldn't it?
But look, this is a topic that not only apparently bothers all of us in this room, but is something that politicians seem to be getting more and more interested in.
Yeah, the market value of UK pension schemes is around £2 trillion. And the big question is whether it's a hidden engine for the UK economy. The City Minister, Andrew Griffith, who's been on this podcast, called yesterday to make equities sexy again, could they be? And Chancellor Jeremy Hunt is expected to lay out his pension plans in July.
Meanwhile, the Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves has thrown her support behind pension firms being forced to contribute to a new £50 billion future growth fund that would invest in UK companies. And the Lord Mayor of the City of London, Nicholas Lyons, was also on Bloomberg Radio telling us that the best minds in the City of London, in his words, were working on that idea of having this growth fund.
So our pension's getting a much needed makeover, from the whipping boy for Britain's financial woes to the key to the growth that Britain so desperately needs. Joining us now to discuss, editor of our Money Distilled newsletter, former executive editor of Money Week as well, John Stepex, here with us. Hey John, great to have you with us. Let's start with a bit of history from all of this, because actually pensions aren't all that old. The private pension plans in the UK only started in 1988. Then a certain Robert Maxwell came along. What happened next?
Yeah, okay, so I think probably the best way to frame this is to talk about the kind of pensions that people have. So you've got defined benefit and you get defined contribution. Defined benefit basically comes in two different flavours. So there's corporate ones, which are now shut to pretty much everyone, and there's public sector ones, which are still open and they're mostly paid out of general taxation. A defined benefit scheme means you know what you're going to get when you retire, and it's someone else's problem to provide that for you, either the taxpayer or the company that, if you're a private sector DB beneficiary. Defined contribution schemes are where you have to pay in and invest over your lifetime, or so your working lifetime, and then at the end of it, you'll have built up a pot that's big enough, you hope, to sustain you through retirement and do everything you want to do during retirement. So basically, that's probably the way to think about the three different kind of schemes which you might have. So what happened with the defined benefit schemes, which is the ones that we're largely talking about here, is that...
The gold-plated ones.
Yeah, the gold-plated ones. I mean, it's definitely the best kind of thing you have. And
wait, but you know how much you're getting, but yes. That might not be enough, maybe.
I mean, it might not be enough, but the point is that... Say you worked for, you know, like a big FTSE 100 company in the 1970s, then you would accrue a certain amount of entitlement over your lifetime to your final salary. And it'd probably be something, you know, accrual rates could be anything like a 40th or a 60th. So for each year you worked at the company, you would get a 40th of your final salary once you retired, and the company would pay that. To be honest, it probably would be enough simply because, you know, if you're getting, say, 50% of your salary at the end of a 20-year career, every year, index linked as well. So these things are linked to inflation. So yeah. No, they are. They're fantastic pensions.
Okay.
It's the same for, nurses and doctors and teachers all have similar types of pensions. The accrual rate, I think, on the teacher scheme is a 40th. I could be wrong.
But the issue is that we've switched, right? From
yes.
So a certain amount of the population in the UK has, you know, the gold plated.
Yes.
They tend to be older.
They don't have to wake up in the middle of the night worrying about their
right,
pensions.
Right,
exactly.
But younger people are on the contribution plan, i.e. you put in, you're not quite sure whether you're going to get enough at the end of it or not. And that's sort of why the landscape has shifted so much, right?
Yeah, exactly. So what happened was that most people were on DB schemes. Over time, in 1991, Robert Maxwell was found naked and dead in the water near his boat, and it turned out he'd pinched everyone's pension money, which was like a
major crisis.
Human tragedy. And I'm not talking about Maxwell dying, I'm talking about all the poor people who didn't have their pensions. So from that point, there was a lot of focus on making defined benefit pensions more secure so that you would definitely get it, because it's a contractual promise essentially to employees. So there were various things happened to make the pensions sort of safer, but that also drove up the cost. There was actually another big change in 1997, which actually doesn't get referred to as much these days, but when Gordon Brown was Chancellor, he changed taxation to dividends. And what that did was it made, cut a long story short, it basically just took a lot of money that companies would have got from claiming back dividend taxation out of the mix. What it also did, though, was it made UK equities less attractive relative to bonds and relative to foreign equities, basically, because there was no longer any reason to invest in UK equities because you didn't get the tax break for doing so. So that might be one issue driving what, you know, we're all about to get to. So essentially the history of private sector defined benefit pension schemes is that they become more expensive, more heavily regulated over time, and as a result, most companies in the UK have stopped offering them. I think there's like one in the FTSE 250 that still offers a defined benefit scheme, but that's it. And now, just to be clear so people don't get confused, people are still getting these. So if you were in the scheme, you know, at the time that it shut down, then you will still get paid it. And if you're a current pensioner, you're still getting paid. But the point is, they are all the private sector ones are now in kind of wind down, essentially. And again, I think we'll probably talk about this in a minute, but that takes you to one of the reasons why these companies aren't investing in UK equities as
okay,
much.
So let's get to then that idea about whether essentially it is a good idea. There seems to be this kind of coalescing around the idea that some money from pension funds is going to be used to invest more into UK assets, UK equities. I mean, that's all the way from big listed companies down to kind of startups, potentially, which is a big range in the financial world of risk that you'd be taking on for that. But what do you make of what's been said?
Well, first of all, I think it's really a bad idea for the government to be mandating what we should have in our pensions. And I think, again, we have to sort of draw a line here. So, and this is talking about the three buckets again. So public sector defined benefit pensions. So the kind of thing the teachers, nurses, firemen, police officers, etc. are getting. Those are paid out of current taxation. So there is no pot, there is no money. The only exception there is the local council pension funds, which is slightly different. The private sector ones, the pot of money is there. But the problem is that it's all been promised to people in the future. And because that those schemes are all in rundown, if you like, so they know now how many pensioners they're going to have to pay out to in the future, and they know what their future liabilities are, the easiest and least risky way to match those liabilities is to stick the money in long-term bonds. I mean, the actuaries would argue a lot about what the exact right discount rate to use and things like that is. But the point is, if these schemes are now shut, then you want to de-risk it as much as possible, because what is the point of sticking all of this money in equities in order to generate more money than you owe the pensioners? You know, you want to get the safest asset possible to make sure you can provide this money to these people.
Yeah, because these are workers from the 70s and 80s, yeah. You know, maybe from the 90s, but they're older workers maybe getting towards retirement.
Exactly.
But that doesn't give you an answer for how to invest in startups and grow the UK economy.
Well, no, and this is when we come to defined contribution pensions. Mm. So defined contribution pensions are the ones that we've all got now, and everyone in this room, I think, has got one, unless you're keeping a DB scheme hidden somewhere.
I'm looking at Lizzie Burden.
In which case, I'll be round your house tonight to mug you.
I may have one and I just don't know.
Well, I doubt it, Lizzie. No, at your age.
It's the sort of thing I wouldn't know. Go on.
So DC pensions. So basically, we just take our own money and we invest it. Or yeah. If it's an employer, then they invest it on your behalf. But it's all going into various funds. The question then is, should the government be able to turn around and say, right, well, actually, all of these schemes are going to have to stick 5% of their assets or 1% of their assets into a fund that we have decided is going to be channeled to UK growth companies, whatever that actually means.
Well, I mean, okay, so then there's the freedom argument, right? It's my money and I want to give it to the best person possible who's going to make me the most amount of money for my retirement. Okay. But then there's the flip side of would it actually work in terms of helping to grow the UK economy? Because that's the other side. Well, if it, you know, we're in a kind of stagnant economy. If all of this money helped to boost the economy and wages and Britain were booming, then maybe I might be convinced that it's a good idea.
Which is surely similar to saying, I don't want my pension invested in big tobacco. I want it in green. You know, this is about the good of the nation and the economy.
I mean, that's absolutely fair in that, you know, everyone at this table is free to choose if they want to buy ESG and if they want to avoid tobacco stocks. And I have absolutely no quarrel with that, because, again, it's your own personal choice. The tricky thing is whenever you're being forced to invest in stuff that has also been, I mean, capital being allocated by the government has not historically gone down terribly well.
Yes, okay.
Exactly. I mean, I genuinely think that the real problem is we're confusing a whole load of different issues here. One is the UK pension system, whereby, you know, it's gone from being kind of a great system under the defined benefit thing to being somewhat less good. And it's improving now. We've got auto-enrolment, which is, again, a slightly separate issue. But the point is that we had something that was very good and then we kind of regulated it and taxed it out of existence. We're mixing that up with the other issue that we've got, which is that the UK has, for some reason, become less appealing as an investment destination. And also this long, long, long-running problem we've had of UK companies not really being able to bridge the gap between being a small company and full-blown commercialisation. And that has gone on for years, for decades. Ever since I've been a financial writer, people have been complaining about this. So it is not a new issue. And this, I don't think, is the way to solve it.
So this isn't a magic elixir to fire up the UK economy then. There's more work outside of this needs to be done. But could it help?
I mean, If you're talking about if you channel a kind of specific amount of capital into a small area, then the beneficiaries of that are going to be the people who get the small amount of capital. But again, it's just capital misallocation. You know, the kind of it's all very well. It's a nice talking point for politicians. And they also, I mean, one reason that politicians kind of love pensions is because it's a captive pot of capital that is locked up there. And they see it and they think, we should be able to do something with that money. But, you know, they forget that it's already accounted for. You know, it's our money. It's not, you know, it's not theirs, it's not to do floating. What they want to.
Also, having written about it for so long, is there another magic pot that the politicians ought to be considering?
There's no magic pot, but what you need to do is, like, cut taxes and deregulate. I mean, I hate to say this, but we have to have some difficult conversations about, look, why is the US so much more attractive to invest in and float in? And, you know, I can tell you for starters, the CEOs get paid more and nobody complains about it. I don't like high CEO pay, but I think we also have to accept that, you know, when you compare it to what's going on in the US, I can see why somebody might want to list there rather than here.
Okay, there's one political point that I just want to make at the end. Is there also a factor that, you know, we have talked about in the past? There's a generational divide in Britain happening in terms of wealth, right? It's entrenched in some senses. Younger voters have to deal with you're paying for their higher education, their university degree. They're in a gig economy, a lot of them. They're struggling to get on the housing market if they're under 40. And this also, they are responsible for investing their money for their retirement, which is immensely tricky, even if you're hugely knowledgeable about it. So, you know, starting at 25, when you've got to pick winners and losers, is this a kind of political horse that can be ridden, I suppose, for the general election?
I mean, yeah, the generation gap is obviously a massively political issue, and you can exaggerate it in certain directions. You know, I mean, I think one thing to remember is that old people are wealthy because they are old. You know, they've accumulated the assets over their lifetimes. At the same time, you're right. You know, if you're a student now, okay, 1 in 2 people go to uni now, whereas it was 1 in 20 when your grandparents were growing up. But, you know, at the same time, it's much more expensive on the individual. You know, they have to pay the graduate tax when they come out. They do have to plan for their pension, which is an incredibly... It's basically you've shifted responsibility for a painful long-term liability onto the individual from, you know, a corporation or from the government. Or sorry, not the government, from the taxpayer. Mm. And that is like a much harder thing to plan for. And it is an added burden. So, I mean, it's definitely something you can exploit as a political kind of weapon.
Okay, John, fascinating to have you as always. John Stepek, author of Bloomberg's Money Distilled newsletter. If you haven't already signed up, I think you've got a pretty good pitch there for all of our listeners. John, thank you very much.
Well, let's get a slightly different take then from the person who calls himself Pension Man UK online, who also happens to be a Bloomberg Opinion columnist. That's Stuart Trow, who is co-host of Money, Money, Money on Switch Radio, also author of The Bluffer's Guide to Economics and previously a strategist at the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development. So we have all of your details, Stuart. We know how expert you are in this field now. So I want to dig into a piece that you've written for Bloomberg, really very critical of what politicians in the UK want to do with people's pensions. You talk about it being a dangerous idea for government to get involved in directing how people's pension pots are invested. Just flesh out why you think it's such a bad idea.
Right, okay. Well, from basic sort of principles, one of the biggest mistakes a long-term investor can make is to have undue home country bias. If you weight the UK in terms of a global equity index, for example, the UK would only justify about 5% holding, and most UK sort of pension pots, especially defined contribution pension pots, probably hold much more than that already. So adding to that bias, if you like, is going to damage returns. And we've already seen that because the FTSE is not one of the strongest performing indices over the past 20 or so years anyway. So it's been a pretty disappointing experience for investors without adding further investment on top of it.
But pension funds elsewhere in the world are more heavily invested in equity markets. I'm thinking of Australia and Canada as examples. Is there something different about the UK case when we look internationally, or what can we learn from other countries about how they've done it?
I think that's a good object lesson, because people, as you say, always mention Australia, always mention Canada, but those markets have performed intrinsically much more strongly than the UK has anyway. You know, the historic returns on some of these markets are much higher. For, you know, in the piece you mentioned that I'd written on the subject, basically the All Ordinaries returned about 64% over the last 5 years, whereas the UK's FTSE 100 only did 30%. And there are all sorts of how you invest in those markets. If you've got a fast growing asset class there, you know, because Australia in particular benefited from the commodity demand from China, you're going to perform well, but you are actually still overexposed to Australia. So if Australia were ever to hit a bump in the road on a sort of idiosyncratic basis, you still might have an inconvenient outcome. Diversification is the rule of not the rule of thumb, but it's what you're seeking to achieve, and undue home bias is the antithesis of that.
But yeah, so on the converse, it seems like a chicken and egg situation. If you want UK startups to grow, you want UK stocks to do better. If you put more money into them, then maybe you'd get more of a return later on. That would be the government's case, surely.
And that's, you know, ostensibly that's quite a reasonable argument. But what's to stop pension companies doing that off their own bat anyway? You know, you're pitching the government as an asset manager against, private pension fund managers. And, you know, people do have all sorts of gripes about private pension fund managers, but there's no real indication that the government would do a better job on that.
Okay, so the government not a good manager of money, potentially. Yeah. I do think there is, though, there's this generational divide. We were talking about it earlier on the programme. You know, younger people have got to make these difficult investments. You know, they're now kind of responsible for basically getting the right returns on their pension. I'm sort of wondering why politicians are pursuing this, and it seems on both sides, on Labour and Conservative sides, they are thinking about this pension money and whether it could be used in some way. Do younger voters care about this issue? Do you think it's a vote winner for any party?
I think that the issue with pensions for everybody, but it affects the young most because they've got the most time at stake, is inertia, to be honest. Most people don't start to engage with what their pensions are actually invested in until sort of later in life. And it's sometimes a bit difficult to sort of overcome that inertia. So if somebody's offering to manage it for you, you know, that can be superficially attractive. But in terms of young people in particular, you know, one of the best thing they can do is basically take diversified, globalized risk. Being too concentrated on the UK is an even worse idea for young people than it is for older people, because older people, by the time they're getting close to retirement, are trying to match their assets and liabilities. So having UK assets against UK liabilities makes some sense. Whereas younger investors are simply going for growth. They want the biggest pot they can possibly get. And that's going to be achieved by having a globally diversified portfolio, not by undue concentration in a underperforming market.
Okay, Stuart Trowe, Bloomberg opinion columnist, among many other hats that you wear. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Let's turn next to trade and Britain's efforts to attract more investment. The Business and Trade Secretary is on a tour of Gulf countries, and she's been speaking to Bloomberg at the Qatar Economic Forum. Our head of economics and government, Stephanie Flanders, started by asking Kemi Badenoch what she hoped to achieve from her trip.
This is all part of a week-long visit to the Middle East as part of our free trade agreement with the Gulf Cooperation Council, which we are negotiating. So this is a region where personal contact is absolutely critical. I need to meet my trade and business counterparts. And a lot of the stuff that we are doing actually relies on getting to know who the people that we are negotiating with, understanding what their concerns are. So it's one of my department's five priorities, just signing high quality trade deals, which should help us drive exports, get lots of investment into the UK. We want to be the top investment destination in Europe, and that's fine.
And we're going to be talking about, we actually have a panel later on, yep, about the structure of trade and how the world's changing. But of course, Britain's biggest trading partner right now is, and for the foreseeable future, is going to be the European Union. Yeah. And there's lots of concern, as you know, among car manufacturers in particular, about what the impact of implementing the rules of origin, full rules of origin, will be. So how can I just ask you where you are in negotiating some kind of fix to that?
So the EU, you're right, is our largest trading partner. We have a free trade agreement with them. But the terms in which we wrote rules of origin conditions don't work now with rising prices of components. This is not a UK problem. It is an EU-UK problem. It works both ways. So both sides are actually interested in looking at what we can do in order to resolve that. The trading continuity agreement is up for review in 2025. We're looking to see what we can do in advance of that because, as you know, there are lots of global headwinds that are affecting the car industry, which means that this is an issue that needs resolution sooner.
Well, it's like, just, are we looking for a short-term fix then before 2025, extending the transition arrangement?
So when we make a final decision, we will announce. We're still in the process of negotiating and discussions with our counterparts. But what I want to say to car manufacturers is that we're very alive to this issue. We have been looking at it long before the story, the most recent story with Stellantis broke. This is something that officials and ministers have been working on along with our international partners. So we should see an answer soon.
And will it be rules of origin? I mean, there's quite a lot of features of the trading cooperation agreement which have been put off, not been fully implemented, which always somewhat suggests that it was not a great trade deal to begin with. I just wonder whether, if you were still trade minister in 2025, would that be your priority for fixing rules of origin?
Every agreement needs constant improvement and updating. There is no agreement that is perfectly fixed in time. That's why many of the free trade agreements which we're negotiating are actually upgrades to existing ones. This, as soon as something is written down, the world changes, things move on. So, no, I don't accept that this was not a good agreement. What we do know now is that the world has changed from when we signed that. If I had written a trade agreement in 2016, it would not have lasted for 2019. It would not have lasted for the pandemic if we'd done one just then, and so on and so forth. And look at what's happened with Russia, Ukraine. Quite a lot of the things which we had put in place just don't work given all the things that are happening in the world. And what we need to do is to be nimble and respond as quickly as possible.
We have known for a long time was that the car industry was moving towards electric cars.
Yes.
And as you know, there's enormous concern around the lack of scale for battery production in the UK and being in effect caught in between the US and the EU on this. How important is it that Tata chooses the UK, not Spain, for its battery plant? And what are you doing to
we want as many people as possible to invest in the UK. The transition to electric vehicles is one that's happening globally, in particular in the West. You have known for a long time that these things take time. You can't just sprint up a battery factory in a matter of months. And it's all about making sure the supply chain is there and it's integrated with the manufacturing sector as well. These two things go hand in hand, but also with the supply of critical minerals. So it is very important that we continue to attract investment, whether it be Tata. We have a gigafactory in Sunderland with Envision. We want to make sure that they stay here and that we have the right incentive package for them to do so. What the Chancellor has said and what the Prime Minister has said is that we're not getting into a subsidies race. If you have a subsidies race, someone's going to lose. Our job is to make sure that the UK doesn't lose, and we need to have a package that is right for our economy and the industry.
Are you still fighting for Tata? Because we hear that they were perhaps leaning towards Spain already.
There are always rumours. There are always rumours.
You haven't given up. How important is it?
I just answered. Of course, it's extremely important, but As you know, it's a live negotiation. Tata will make its decision. We're doing everything we can to show that the UK is the best place for them to invest. They have a long-standing relationship with us. You look at JLR, you look at the steel factory in Steelworks, pardon me, in Port Talbot. We have a strong relationship with Tata. I was in India just a few months ago. We have a free trade agreement, which is going to benefit, that we're negotiating, which is going to benefit them. So we're doing everything we can, but negotiations are still ongoing.
On the India trade deal, I mean, obviously one of the things that the Indians are concerned about is improving the conditions for visas, making it easier for skilled Indians to get visas. That's been a stumbling block. Obviously, the politics around migration extremely hot.
Yes, and so it's really important that we separate migration from mobility for business. They're not the same thing. We don't deal with migration as a whole in free trade agreements. It's only really business mobility. And it hasn't been a stumbling block. It is just one other thing that needs negotiating. If all these things were easy, we wouldn't need
this year. Is it going to happen this year?
I'm not giving a date. Previous ministers have given dates, and then the political environment and the economic environment have changed that. It's about the substance and about the deal, not the day. And so what I'm working on is making sure that we have a high quality deal for the UK.
Okay, the last question. Are you worried about, there are a lot of senior business leaders, Dyson, from different industries, talking about Britain as not being open for business, about worrying about the climate, worrying about the government's approach to business. Who are you talking to? How are you trying to confront?
So I am meeting at least two CEOs a week for very large companies, FTSE 100 companies. They are saying different things. What James Dyson says is very different from what the CEOs of banks say. They do worry about the global economy, and they want to know that the UK is going to continue to be a stable place for them to invest. There are some incidents, for instance, the Microsoft Activision ruling that came from the CMA, which they complained about. I don't think that's actually a sign of the UK not being a good place to do business. That was a ruling that was made because it impacted competition, and it didn't look like it would be good for consumers from our regulators' perspective. So we need to look at all of those things in the round. But we are having good conversations with business. We're making changes such as the Chancellor's Edinburgh reforms. We're looking at encouraging listings in the London Stock Exchange. But we are open to business, and we have a good relationship with them.
Business and Trade Secretary Kemi Badenoch speaking there to our head of Bloomberg Economics and Government, Stephanie Flanders.
Well, what did you make then of what she was talking about in terms of industrial strategy? I mean, the government is under huge pressure to deliver this now.
Yeah, it's interesting that she says they haven't given up on Tata, or that Stephanie had to infer that from what she didn't say. I also thought it was interesting, there was no date set for the India trade deal. Of course, that was one of the many post-Brexit prizes. And then she tried to separate business visas from wider migration from India when, you know, Rishi Sunak's tried to separate legal and illegal migration. In the voters' minds, they're all one and the same. And it comes back to what Suella Braverman's been talking about in recent weeks.
Yeah, certainly plenty to discuss. And Suella Braverman, of course, someone else that's been in the news too, and perhaps something that we will have time to discuss as we watch the latest developments around that story and the questions over her request to civil servants, as reported by the Sunday Times and discussed by us in the show yesterday as well. But for now, that is it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe, give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Walcock. Our audio engineer was John Wasserman. I'm Caroline Hepke.
I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Success, it's discipline, it's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management and investment banking firms in the industry. Stifel, it's where success meets success. Start your journey at stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.